Hey everybody, welcome to another edition of The Journey of Hope. We're so glad you could be with us again this week. The Journey of Hope is a podcast that's especially designed to address the issues that men and women face after incarceration. Trish Jenkins is on the show today. She's calling in from Australia. We're going to talk to Trish about her road down incarceration and the reintegration that she experienced, and I hope that by listening to her story that you'll be able to pull some things that will help you in your parole or your probation, or if your sentence is discharged, moving back into society. Trish Jenkins, right after this. You're listening to The Journey of Hope. I'm Rodney Mathis. Love to get those emails. You can always catch me at mathersrodney@yahoo.com. That's mathersrodney@yahoo.com. Drop me a line. Hi, y'all. My guest today is Trish Jenkins. Trish has written a book that all of us who listen to this show can relate to, Treasures of Darkness, A Prison Journey. And Trish says that you can change the past and free your future. I just absolutely love that quote. I think you're going to enjoy Trish's story. Trish Jenkins, welcome to The Journey of Hope.
Hi, thanks, Rodney. Great to be here.
Trish is calling in from Australia. And Trish, where exactly are you in Australia?
I'm in Brisbane, which is on the eastern seaboard in the north. It's our sunshine state. So we're just coming into spring here.
I was going to ask you what season it is there. You're going into spring.
Oh, sorry. No, we're coming into autumn. Sorry.
Oh, I see. Okay.
No, because you're coming into spring, aren't you?
We're right there. As a matter of fact, we got a little spring thunderstorm outside right now. Let's start with how you ended up in prison, Trish. Can you give us a little bit of background so that we know how you got there?
Yes. Yeah, basically what happened was, over here in Australia, we had a property boom. And back in the late 90s and early part of the last decade, and my husband and I accumulated a number of properties, and we went along to a lot of seminars, and they were very good, and we listened to great people like Robert Kiyosaki and these motivational books that he wrote, the Rich Dad Poor Dad books, and that worked, and we bought properties and we accumulated them, but there's not a lot of cash flow in properties here, and so I was looking for cash flow, and a person introduced me to a fellow who was a currency trader. Now, I wasn't very good at trading myself, but I knew some people were. And so we loaned him some money to trade with, and that went well. And then he asked me to be a contact person for other people to trade, so they could give him some money to trade with, which I agreed to. And look, it may sound foolish, but we thought this was a blessing. We thought this was the fruit of us all doing our giving and our sowing, and, you know, we've been great givers. And, you know, we've been taught in church that if you give, God will bless you, and that sort of thing. And so it created a blind spot for us. And so people gave me money to give to him. That's not what I did that was wrong. What happened was, after a year and a half, he suddenly stopped paying. And it was my job to tell everybody that we weren't getting paid. Mm-hmm. And that was 1 month. And then the second month, I had to do the same thing. And people became more fearful and aggressive, and I didn't want to look at my emails because I'd feel a bit worried and sick. And by the third month of him not paying, I just basically caved under the pressure, and people had still been giving me money to give to him, and that last bit of money, I said to him, look, we need to pay these people, can I just use this? And he said, all right, let's do that. And what I did that was wrong was that people had given me money to give to him, and I used that to pay all the investors.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was wrong. And I knew it was wrong, Rodney, but I had lost my perspective. And the unfortunate thing is, anybody that I would have gone to for advice, whether it be church leaders or even my financial advisor and accountant, they had their money in. So it's very difficult to go to someone and say, I'm worried about this, when they've got their money in. You can't get objective advice from that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's not to say that it's their fault. It's just that I felt like I had nowhere to go.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I did. And then he was reported to the ASIC, which is the Australian Securities and Investments Commission, probably the equivalent of your SEC.
Right.
And so I went to them and for an interview, and I said, look, this is what's been going on. This is what I did to try and fix it. What do we do now? And they couldn't get past what I'd done. And I was advised to go into voluntary liquidation, and I did that. And that meant that all of our properties, everything we had was sold up, which was supposed to go to creditors, but really it just goes to paying the fees of the liquidators. I don't know if you use that phrase over there, but it's where a company takes over your financial affairs to try and sort you out and supposedly help you. But often what they do, their job is also to sell you up and give the money to creditors. It's very similar to a bankruptcy.
Right.
And anyway, that took about 2 years, and then I got a letter informing me that I was to be prosecuted, which was very frightening.
I imagine.
And that took another year and a half, during which time I worked for a corporate investigator promoting his services, because he was someone that I discovered too late, and if I had known him, I would never have touched this fellow, because I would have been able to check him out more thoroughly. So I learned a lot about fraud warning signals. And then January 2009, finally, and I'd never denied what I'd done, I was pleading guilty. January 2009, I went to court, and it didn't matter that I hadn't stolen any money, I had still done the wrong thing with it. So I came home 8 months later.
Well, that's something we can relate to here. And I also want to tell you, we don't judge people here on this show. We know that a lot of people make mistakes. Now, had you been in trouble of any kind before? You'd never been in trouble, had you?
Look, I was what they called in prison. The others called me a 180 straighty, which meant that I was straight in both my personal lifestyle and my personal preferences, as well as the way that I just did life. And, you know, I was black and white Christian, leader in my church, and just made this mistake. And I learned in there as well that, you know, we've already been judged. So the only judgment I have to worry about after that is the one before God.
That's right. Well, you know, all of us that have been to prison have experienced something that you write about quite extensively in your book, and that is the loss of dignity. And I'm curious about how you dealt with that while you were being kind of initiated into the prison culture. How did you deal with that?
Yes, that's a very good question. There were a couple of stages. The most terrifying time was sitting in the dock in the court, not knowing what was going to happen. And once the sentence was handed down, I actually had a sense of relief, which might be hard to understand, but I had no idea how long I was going to get. And I thought, if I get less than a year, that'll be a good thing. And I went into a kind of different zone, a bit like if you've had someone close to you pass away and you're the one who's got to handle all the funeral arrangements, you kind of put aside your grief and get on with the job, and then it comes back to you later. So it was almost like I was observing myself and everything that went around me. My senses were heightened and I noticed everything. And I also made a mental note that I have to remember everything for some reason. And I was in the lockup, which is where generally it's meant to be temporary, where they throw the drunks in overnight, but I was there for almost a week, and I had no pen and paper. I couldn't get a cup of tea. We Aussies love our
Imagine.
Tea, like your coffee. We like coffee too, but it's the first thing I have in the morning. I miss that, and the others weren't allowed to smoke. It was very primitive, and I had to remember everything, and as soon as I got out to the prison I had access to stationery, I just wrote everything I could remember, because I don't have a great memory. And I knew I had to record it. And part of my coping mechanism was to write everything down. And the other part of my coping mechanism was obviously drawing on God and trusting in that scripture he'd laid on my heart that it's not the end. This is for a higher purpose, that all things work together for good for those who love him. And the other thing is that I don't feel bitter towards the judge and the sentence, because he's, you know, I really felt like God said to me, this is your journey with me. And that judge was just a mouthpiece. He was just a puppet.
Well, Trish,
what God had in mind. Even though God didn't make me do the wrong thing, obviously, I did. But God has created a greater plan out of that experience.
That's, and, Trish, that's, let me interrupt you right there. That's what I want to get to, and that's why I ask you the question about how you dealt with that. How did the strength that you derived from dealing with prison conditions apply to your life once you were released?
Oh, look, that was a whole different thing. Again, it's like you have this journey in a fishbowl where all the conditions are fairly controlled, and you get a handle on that. But then when you come out, there's all these variables that hit you. And I felt like, hang on, I'm with respectable people here now. And there would be disapproval. And I had a really hard time letting people know that I had been to jail. It was just humiliating. And you know, people here say, oh, well, you know, people who come out of jail, they should just get a job and start contributing to society again.
Yeah,
well, that would be all right if somebody would give you a job.
Right.
When on an application, you have to disclose that you've been to prison. Now, my background is sales and business, so it really doesn't look good that when you say, yes, I have, and if yes, give details, oh, yes, that was fraud.
Well, that's something that we deal with. Trish, that's something that we deal with here too as well. You know, we get that same kind of attitude. Why don't you just go back to work? Well, it's not as easy as you might think. It sounds like y'all run into the same problems there as well. And a lot of us have to reinvent ourselves. You know, I really like the way the book is laid out. You journaled and you went into some of your letters, I couldn't help but notice that you seem in some parts, to me anyway, to have a sense of humor. You talked about a distasteful run-in with a prison nurse, and a little later in a letter you sent out, you open the letter with saying, "I'm having the most amazing time." And my question would be, how important is a sense of humor, as you know, we're not only dealing with the situation in prison, but we're talking more about upon release. A sense of humor upon release, how important is that? Is that important?
It is absolutely important. When we take ourselves too seriously, we'll just get smashed. You know, it was just, to me, the whole situation, it was just so ridiculous that it was funny to me. Now, I do have a bit of a warped sense of humor anyway, but on release, it was a little harder. But I found that in the telling, people are actually very interested in prison and what it's like, because they don't know. They think mm-hmm. of it as being what it's like in the movies.
Right.
And so I was able to tell them stories, and watching their reactions, I thought, oh my goodness, I just can't, you know, from a normal person's point of view, some of those stories are really shocking and
Absolutely.
Ridiculous and funny. When you're in the situation, you don't realise just how bizarre it is. So, you know, you just have to, you know, asking God for his perspective. You know, God has a sense of humour as well. You know, he's a great one for irony. And so if you take yourself a little less seriously, and you can do that when you know God's in control mm-hmm. and you can trust him, and you put your pride, I mean, your pride's been pretty smashed, but, you know, it's still there, and that's why we feel ashamed and embarrassed.
Mm-hmm.
But it's God who we trust in,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, trusting that he's able to work all things for good, and knowing that down the track things will be different, mm-hmm. and we can really observe the journey a little bit more objectively.
Trish, we're going to take a real quick break. My guest today is Trish Jenkins. We're talking about her book, Treasures of Darkness, A Prison Journey. We're going to be right back. You're listening to Journey of Hope. I'm Rodney Mathers. Rodney Mathers here for the Jam Buddy Chord Chart. You like to play music and you want to be able to play in a bunch of different keys. How about every key and do it all the time? There's a product out there for you. It's called the Jam Buddy Chord Chart. It uses something called the Nashville Numbering System, which allows you to play songs in any key. And I want you to check this thing out. The way you check it out is you go to angiesbanjo.com. That's angiesbanjo.com. You click on the link for the Jam Buddy Chord Chart and you get a free one-page sample. You're going to like this thing if you're into music. It's the Jam Buddy Chord Chart and it's found at angiesbanjo.com. Thank you. Hey there, and welcome back. We're talking to Trish Jenkins about her prison experience. Trish, one of the many points you bring out is the hypocrisy that you found in prison, and I found that too, especially to be true of some of the guards. And if you'll just follow me, I'm leading to a point here that to me, the guards that brought in contraband, you have people in prison who have been so drawn into maybe addictions that it's cost them their freedom, and then you have a guard selling drugs to them. It made me angry, and here's my point. Did you find things in there that made you angry, and you held that anger after your release?
I did, Robbie. They do all these rehabilitation programs that are supposed to make us better people. And I come from a background where I was very well brought up and I'm fairly well educated. Mm-hmm. So those programs weren't really applicable to me, but they're very important for some of the people there. And I did them anyway. I did a lot of education. I did them anyway just for something to do. And so to have officers and non-custodial staff treat us like we were just the very, very bottom and undeserving of any kind of respect, that made me angry. And it made me more angry when I saw them do it to other people and I could do nothing. Probably the most traumatic experience that I had where that was concerned. Now, I didn't see any illegal, as in technically illegal activities. I didn't see any drugs brought in. I didn't see any drugs.
Come to Texas.
I was a bit like Mr. Magoo. All these things were going on around me and I just didn't see them. And I think that comes from not really being familiar with it anyway, because I was such a straighty. But
I love that term, straighty.
I was in S1, which is where the bad girls go. I'd had an issue with somebody, and I lost my temper with someone, and I didn't hit them, but I was sent to S1, which is not quite the hole, but it's pretty awful.
Okay.
And these officers came in with a dog, and they had us line up, and they had the dog go past us sniffing, and they said, step forward, and they sent the dog past, step back, sent the dog past, and then he just said, step forward, step back, and didn't let the dog pass. And he was just playing games and humiliating us. And then they would go into each woman's cell and turn it upside down. And not as bad as they used to in the old days where they would tip everything out, but they would just really thoroughly search it, and the profanity that they're not supposed to swear at us, but the profanity that they used. And I just remember being really, really angry. And I did start to say something, because this man, he was a small, skinny man with a lot of attitude, shorter than some of us, and really nasty looking. And I didn't realise I was thinking out loud, and I was thinking about when you humiliate people who are weaker than you, it makes you small on the inside as well. And I actually started to say it out loud, and he rushed over and said, "What did you say?" And then fortunately there was a distraction, and he went off, and I thought, oh my goodness, I can't believe that I had muttered something about, small men and small minds. Being bullies. And I was very, very lucky then, because, not so long ago, before the prison system had been overhauled, it would be nothing. Nobody, if they had gone in and belted someone up, none of us would have been able to do anything about it, and we wouldn't have been believed if it had been reported. But they have a lot more checks and balances in place now. That was really frightening, that some of these people who were taking care of us, I knew that they would probably be going home and taking drugs themselves.
Right.
Now, I couldn't prove it, obviously, but I just, just the way they looked and the way they behaved, I thought, you're a lawless man.
Yep.
And here you are looking after us and looking down on us. They weren't all like that, of course. Many of them were very good and very professional.
Right.
But a lot of them just didn't care.
Well, I guess the point of getting into this line of discussion with you is you carry some of that anger home with you, and people listening to the show are in the same boat. And so Can you give us some advice on how you dealt with that anger once you were home? I mean, how did you get past that?
Gee, it's nice to hear someone else refer to the anger that we feel. Thank you for bringing that up. It was awful. I've never felt rage in my life like I had after I came home, when a disproportionate rage to an event, and it frightened me. And at other times I would be totally insensitive to a difficulty somebody might be facing because I was hardened as well.
Right.
And it alarmed me. And when my 11-year-old acted like an 11-year-old, I would overreact because she was acting like these grown women did when they had a little tantrum.
That's right.
They were acting like they're 11. She was acting like a normal child.
That's right.
And so my husband had to intervene and tell me that, hey, you know, you're overreacting with your yelling and screaming and potential for worse. Mm-hmm. And losing my temper, there were a number of things that I did, and it took time. One is, I just had to quiet my world. I was really in no shape to go looking for work, because that was an extra pressure. I wasn't entitled to any help from the system that damaged me, because my husband had a job, and therefore I couldn't get any free help. But someone very kindly sent me a link to a network called the Bridge Network, which are a group of psychologists who agree to what we call in Australia bulk bill psychology for people who have been in prison. Now, what that means is it's like when you're very poor, you can get free healthcare. Mm-hmm. And that was part of it. So I wasn't poor enough to get free healthcare, except that these psychologists offered it to people who'd been in jail. Mm-hmm. So I saw a fellow for a year and a half, and that was very helpful because he was able to show me that what I was going through was quite common and gave me some strategies to cope with and to go easy on myself instead of beating myself up afterwards after I'd lost my temper and hurt my children's feelings and so on. They're very forgiving. I love them, and I would apologise to them, and I'd just say, you know, help, you know, I just need help. Mm-hmm. And they would pray for me, and I would pray for myself. And another thing, that I had spiritual counselling as well. I actually took myself and the children off to a friend of mine who has a deliverance ministry, because mm-hmm. I didn't know what I might have picked up, and I just wanted to cross the T's and dot the I's. Mm-hmm. You've got to be careful who you go to for things like that. Because there are a few, you know, loose cannons out there. But, I've been sleeping in the beds that people had slept in who had killed people and had all sorts of awful things. So
that's right.
I just knew I carried some of that atmosphere with me of prison. Because it felt like, and you may relate to this, you know, when you go to the beach and you're in the surf and you're walking back into the beach area, and you don't realise that a wave is coming up behind you, and as it does, it just sweeps over you, and you almost sort of totter on your feet and get knocked over.
Mm-hmm.
And it felt like when you're on the outside, you're going along okay, and then this whole prison atmosphere just sweeps over you like that wave does,
mm-hmm.
and leaves you feeling vulnerable and defenceless. And,
great analogy.
And like the very same feeling that you carry when you're in there sometimes, and that was really hard. So I got help, I got counselling. The biggest thing that I did, though, was remember my prayer that I used while I was in prison.
Mm-hmm.
God, show me your perspective. Your word says that you will deliver me and that there will be honour at the end of this, that you have a plan for my life and that there's nothing that can happen in my life that you cannot turn around for good. So I had to heal for a while, and the episodes of anger grew fewer. As I started to focus on the future, I thought less about the past, because sometimes thinking about the past in a particular incident would make me angry all over again. But focusing on the future, knowing that there was a future,
mm-hmm.
because I had nothing else, that, you know, I have a great husband, which is very fortunate, but in the end, what you have in yourself is your faith, and that God is totally trustworthy. But we've got to do our part to work hand in hand for him to be able to give us a future. And that takes courage, and it takes personal discipline as well.
Okay. Trish, I've got, you know, one more final question here that we deal with a lot on the Journey of Hope, and it's kind of touchy, but I'm assuming that when you did what they said you did, what you pled guilty to, that there were victims. There were people who had lost money as part of investing. Am I wrong to assume that?
No, there were, yes.
Okay. And most people that go to prison, unless they've got like a drug charge, they probably have a victim of some sort. And so my question is, what advice can you give us about reconciling in your life the creating of a victim of a crime? How do you forgive yourself? Is it something you dwell on? How do you deal with that?
Oh, look, you know, it's one thing to lose your own money. It's another thing to play a role in other people losing money, right? And they're your family and they're your friends, and they're people who may have lost their life savings. Mm-hmm. And even though people understood, and I understood, that I hadn't actually stolen it, I had still played a role in their loss.
Mm-hmm.
And that guilt just nearly finished me.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one night, it was before I went away, because this took, you know, the offence was 05, and, you know, prison wasn't till 09. And I remember going for a drive and parking up a dark street and just praying and crying and screaming at God. I was screaming the names of the people who were suffering losses.
Mm-hmm.
And just saying, what about this person? What about that person? You know, and I felt this voice. I just felt it just quietly say, you know, and I said, what about Tom? And he said, that's between me and Tom.
I
stopped. And I realized I can't make Tom respond in a godly way. That is between him and God, how he responds to what has happened. I can only carry my own burden and repent of my own sin where it stops. If I try and expand that, I can't do it. I can't look for approval from other people, even though I want it. I've got to accept that some people, no matter what I do or how sorry I am or how much I've paid for, they're still going to be angry and bitter. And I need to let that go.
Yes.
Not only have I repented, I've actually paid for it with loss of freedom.
Right.
Most people who sin, all they have to do is repent and say sorry. There's no retribution on their part,
mm-hmm.
Unless it be a loss of relationship. But they're not publicly punished and humiliated for what they do.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to accept man's justice and understand God's grace. And in most cases, people were good about it, but I still carried that same burden. And I have new friends now, and when I do meet people, I am not arrogant about it. I don't say, well, I've paid for that. But I let them know just how sorry I am for what's happened to them and the part that I played in it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing more that I can really do except
That's right.
Hope that what I'm doing now to make a difference in people's lives is going to be a help.
Excellent.
You can't
Excellent.
Really control other people's reactions.
No, you can't. And Trish, that was a very eloquent answer to that very difficult question, and I agree with you 100%. Now, look, you've written some other books. Tell us about those and how we can get a hold of those and this one as well.
Yeah, sure. Before I went to prison, because it was going on for a long time, I needed to know how it was that I failed and how I got caught and was deceived. And so I was working for a corporate investigator who taught me a lot, and he said, can you write a book for women? because by the time they call me, I can't help them. They've run out of money. So I wrote Dangerous Wealth, What Every Successful Woman Needs to Know to Avoid Being Ripped Off. And I didn't publish it, though. I didn't publish it till after I got out of prison because I thought, how can I put a book out without people finding out I've been to jail? And that was another journey with God where I came to the realisation that my message is more important than my pride. And so I did publish that one. That was 2010 that I did that. Just self-publishing. And then about a year after I came home, my husband said to me, it's time for you to put your notes and letters together, because I've been writing letters from prison to our friends and family. I said to my husband, can I write just one to you, take out the bits that are just for you, and you type it out as an email to this handful of people. So we did that. And that mailing list grew, and it went viral. And I was receiving letters of encouragement from people that I didn't even know as a result of these emails. And that became a coping mechanism as well, because I was sharing my overcoming obstacles in God and my strategies and making myself forgive and what that actually looked like and felt like throughout the book. These were these letters. And what I couldn't write in letters, I wrote in private notes because the officers read all the letters and I didn't want anyone getting in trouble. So I kept the private journal. And that's when Christmas before last, I put those together and created another book, which is the Treasures of Darkness book, A Prison Journey. And then a year ago in March, I began speaking to businesses about the message that I had about fraud warning signals and overcoming adversity. And the men were not fussed on buying my women's book. So I, towards the end of the year, I created another book, which is the same content. You know, one person should not buy both of these books because it's the same content, but I just reworded it to be more suitable for men as well as women.
Okay.
And that one is called Weapons of Cash Destruction.
And how do we find those?
Fortune from Fraud.
Trish, how do we find those?
It's just at my website, which is trishjenkins.co. It's not .com, that's someone else. So it's just trishjenkins.co, and there will be links on there. If you look at the pages where the books actually are, there are links to where you can order it in America, because the postage is cheaper for you there.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't matter. If it comes through the normal sales page, the shop, then I'll get that message and I'll just order it directly from the printer in America and send it to you, because the postage is a lot cheaper for you.
Well, great.
Send it from Australia.
Excellent. The book is called Treasures of Darkness, A Prison Journey. Trish Jenkins, thank you so much for being here. We're going to take another quick break. You're listening to The Journey of Hope. I'll be right back. I want to thank my special guest today, Trish Jenkins, calling all the way from Australia. How cool is that? And I want to remind you of something. If God is for you, who can be against you? We'll see you next time right here on The Journey of Hope.